From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, a portrait of Valeria Luiselli, live from the 92nd Street Y. Valeria Luiselli is a Mexican writer and a novelist who lives in New York City. She's pretty incredible. Her first novel, Faces in the Crowd, won the LA Times Art Seidenbaum Award for first fiction. Her second novel, The Story of My Teeth, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. But Valeria's most recent work isn't a novel at all. It's titled Tell Me How It Ends, an essay in 40 questions, and it chronicles her time when she worked as a translator for Central American unaccompanied children, many of whom came during the 2014 spike of the arrival of these kids, who a lot of people call refugees. Her book reveals the humanity behind what is actually a very bureaucratic process.
Why did you come to the United States? That's the first question on the intake questionnaire for unaccompanied child migrants. The questionnaire is used in the Federal Immigration Court in New York City, where I started working as a volunteer interpreter in 2015. My task there is a simple one. I interview children following the intake questionnaire and then translate their stories from Spanish to English. But nothing is ever that simple. I hear words spoken in the mouths of children, threaded in complex narratives. They are delivered with hesitance, sometimes distrust, always with fear. I have to transform them into written words, succinct sentences, and barren terms. The children's stories are always shuffled, stuttered, always shattered beyond the repair of a narrative order. The problem with trying to tell their story is that it has no beginning, no middle, and no end.
Valeria Luiselli read this passage from her book when we met recently at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan. And we were there for a talk about her new book in front of a live audience. But we ended up talking about much more than just her writing. From the United States' shared history with Latin America, to being Mexican in New York, to whether or not you should drink coffee when you're pregnant. Today on the podcast, we share a part of that live conversation with you. Here's a portrait of Valeria Luiselli.
Seriously, I never thought that I would be here at the 92nd Street Y with another paisana talking about this. So it's kind of like, what's going on? And I'm so thankful to everybody involved in making this happen. I'm really, really thankful and glad to be here. I think that this is actually kind of historic, maybe even a little bit radical. So actually, this is a question that my producer, Antonia Cerejido, decided that she wanted to be the first question. She's my producer, and so I take direction very well. So I'm going to give Antonia credit for this. The question is, why did you come to the United States?
my situation is very different from the situation that the kids have, the kids that I worked with in court, the kids that I work with in Long Island. I came here for the first time in my early 20s. Because, like Alma Guillermo Prieto, who you must know, I wanted to be a dancer.
What? Yeah, me too.
You too?
And Alma Guillermo Prieto. Wow. So there are all these Mexican
a generation
women end up in New York
wanting to be failed Mexican dancers. I'm really glad we failed, though, because I mean, in my case, I was maybe going to add another body to a big choreography, but not really contribute to the history of dance in any way. I never had talent, really. I had a problem with rhythm, which is really a bad problem to have when you're a dancer. So I tried really hard, and I came here, and I just stayed. There's really no way for me to do what I do if I lived in Mexico.
So I want to read a part of your book. You say, before coming to the United States, I knew what others know, that the cruelty of its borders was only a thin crust, and that on the other side, a possible life was waiting. You continue, I understood sometime after that once you stay here long enough, you begin to remember the place where you originally came from, the way a backyard might look like from a high window in the deep of winter, a skeleton of the world, a tract of abandonment, objects dead and obsolete. And once you're here, you're ready to give everything, or almost everything, to stay and play a part in the great theater of belonging. Those words. I was like, no, we're all just playing a part in the great theater of belonging.
The thing is, this absolutely sinister everydayness in which we live now makes certain things that were in the shadows so much more clear and apparent. And what I feel now, and that sometimes enrages me, is that in this theater of belonging, the immigrant is expected to, the one who arrives is expected to always play the role and tell the story of the good immigrant, right? Of the one who wants to assimilate. But why don't we allow ourselves to mix more? No? There's something about the myth of migrating to America that implies letting go of so many things and simply abiding by a series of things. This is a country, for example, where this is the second largest Hispanic country in the world. There's 60 million people in this country that speak Spanish, for example. This is after Mexico, it's the US, then Spain, then Colombia. But we don't consider ourselves as a Hispanic country, as also a Hispanic country. And so many of us Hispanics that come to the US leave our language behind, for example. So I think that we have to start a conversation about how really we want to play a part in that theater of belonging.
I'm wondering, the reason why the title of your book is Tell Me How It Ends is because of your daughter, who says, Mama, and how does it end? ¿Y cómo termina? And so I'm wondering about the fact that you decided to have a daughter in the United States.
No, she's my anchor baby in Mexico, actually.
Oh. So,
no, I said, no, I'm having her in Mexico.
Okay, so what's up with that?
I mean,
you're just like, no, I'm not going to have her here.
I mean,
take part in the theater of belonging, but I'm not going to have my child here.
I'll tell you the full story later, but
okay, the condensed version.
Here, the condensed version. I mean, basically, yeah, I was starting my PhD here, and having a baby alone here, starting a PhD was just not. Plus, like, I went to the first American gynecologist, and I said, oh my God, no, I would not be able to take 9 months of this.
You mean the neuroses of the OB-GYN.
The neuroses, you can't have coffee, you can't do this, don't ride a bicycle. Don't. I was like, no, like I can't do this, no? So yeah, first I went to a residence, like a literary residence with my husband in Italy. There, all the women that I met convinced me that 3 or 4 coffees a day were perfectly fine. My daughter is incredibly smart, sophisticated, hates coffee. Everything's okay. You know? She's 8, and then the rest of my pregnancy, I passed in Mexico, riding my bicycle, dancing, and being perfectly happy. And then I came back when we amassed enough savings and conditions for me to return here to finish my PhD. We did.
As an interpreter, how much did you know of what you were going to be hearing? Did you have an inkling at all?
I had a crash course with a lawyer who's now become my good friend. I think she maybe is here because she's a super fan of yours. She gave me a crash course, first on the phone, like long conversations about what it was going to be like, what to expect, what the intake questionnaire was, what the mechanics of it was really. Other than that, nothing.
Did you know about La Hielera?
I knew about La Hielera from reading, and
so for there may be some people who don't know. La Hielera means
the icebox.
Icebox.
So ICE is Immigration and Customs Enforcement, as you know. So the ice boxes, which in Spanish are called hieleras, are basically detention spaces. The first detention space where sometimes families are taken upon their arrival in the U.S. when they're apprehended. And it's called a hielera because it's freezing cold space. It's basically like being put into a refrigerator for a long amount of time. And the maximum time that people are supposed to spend in there is 72 hours, but often they spend much more time than that. Children often tell horror stories and say that, for example, they're not allowed to go to the bathroom as often as they need to. They're given like frozen food that they can't really eat. So it's a very unwelcoming first arrival, right?
It is difficult to prove the damage of being held in an icebox.
Scars are
you don't have
there.
A scar.
Yeah, and children don't mention when you. I read the questions earlier. Some of the questions in the questionnaire. One of them is, have you been hurt by anyone since you came to the United States? Something like that. And children don't list that often. Some may tell if they had a particularly horrible story, may say something about the icebox, but they don't even list it as an abuse to human rights, or as a violation of their rights, what they go through in there. One thing that happens in the iceboxes, for example, is that they're vaccinated. As soon as they arrive, they're given vaccinations. And often, what happened once, for example, in I think 2016, was that they were given, I think a couple of hundred children were given adult doses of hepatitis vaccination. So they all ended up in the hospital. Some of them very serious health conditions because they had just irresponsibly been vaccinated.
Coming up on Latino USA, Valeria Luiselli on the complicated relationship between Mexico and the United States. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Love trivia, puzzles, nerdy games, and humor? What about interviews with actors, musicians, and people from all walks of life? Yeah? Then join me, Ophira Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another, every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, we're back, and we're going to jump back into our conversation with Mexican author Valeria Luiselli. And we're going to pick things up talking about immigration, detention, and that very complicated relationship between Mexico and the United States.
Sometimes people think that this is, you know, especially right now, in this precise moment, sometimes people point fingers at one party or another. And I think in your book, actually, you lay so much blame at so many people's feet, including the Mexican government. And in a lot of ways, the United States is forcing this upon Mexico, right? In the sense, well, certainly with the notion of build a wall.
And funding programs so that Mexico deports before they do.
So now you've got Mexican immigration agents that are basically mirroring U.S. immigration agents.
Yeah. I mean, there was a Mexican politician who died some years ago, and he used to say that Mexico era el patio trasero de Estados Unidos, no? We're like the backyard, sort of where all things are thrown. And in a way, yes. And in many ways, we are to blame for the for such a submissive acceptance, right? I mean, the U.S. is the world's economic and military power. It's not like you can just say no so easily, right? But there's little resistance, I often feel, in Mexico, little discussion around important things like this, like becoming basically the chief platform of deportation of Central American and Haitian migrants. The southern border in Mexico is now more militarized than ever. Drones, it looks like someone's sinister fantasy of a video game, no? The way that Mexico is playing this role in deporting so that Central American migrants don't even reach the American border is shameful. And in Mexico, Central American migrants do have as well a right to due process and to seeking asylum, but that's not even a conversation that's really happening there. So, I mean, as fiercely critical as I am of the U.S., I am also of Mexico.
For anybody who hasn't read the book yet, just give us who's a sense of Manuel López, and why does he become kind of a central character in your book?
So Manu, whose real name is of course not Manu, he was the first person that I interviewed in court, actually. And he was like this very tough catracho from Honduras. And he was then, I guess, 16. I mean, unfortunately, I am his translator. And I say unfortunately because basically, although he was able to get a SIJ visa, he applied for a work permit that is now, it's now expired. And he simply hasn't received the new one. So he had to get a job that's not great, in which they have to pay him cash because the banks won't accept his checks. He had to leave school because in school he lives in a very, very difficult, very violent town in Long Island, which is the same town where I happen to teach, a town called Hempstead in Long Island. And he started going to high school there, Hempstead High. And after a few weeks, there were boys that called themselves part of the MS-13 that were trying to get him to join them. And he had been escaping from the Maras in Honduras. He had lost his best friend to the Maras in Honduras. They had shot his best friend in front of him. So he had fled. And now he comes to the U.S. and it's the same guy.
And what exactly, do you remember exactly what he says about?
He said, Hempstead is the same as Tegucigalpa. Like, I don't know why I came here, if it's exactly the same. And what is very frustrating, I think, especially for teenagers in that circumstance, is that feeling of like not being able to wake up from a nightmare, that you're stuck. You're stuck. There's no way out, it seems.
You know, there is this, there's kind of the specificity of the dynamic of Central America tied to the United States that people seem to forget.
Yeah. We have no historical memory, you know, that the years of intervention, of American intervention in through the CIA.
What is your reaction when you encounter people who know absolutely nothing about this?
We have a series of historical shared responsibilities as a hemisphere, as a region. And it's not about pointing fingers and saying, the Reagan administration was the one that funded the massacre against the Central America, against the Salvadoran population, who then had to take refuge, some of them, in the United States. And that's where the Mara was born. And we are a region. It's the notion of nation state is a very limited notion now to understand a very complex world. I mean, it always has been, but now more than ever. So we have to think in terms of regions And in this particular problem, there's no way to isolate the countries and therefore try to explain what's happening. It's not like there's a local gang problem in Central America and a local drug war in Mexico and then whatever else in the U.S. It's years of shared history. And these children that are arriving here and seeking asylum are casualties of a very long war that we as a society here, and Mexico as well, have a responsibility to take in. And the only way we can do that is being responsible enough to document ourselves, so to go out and then read history and read the... maybe even go to the newspaper archives and understand. So that's usually, I think, the argument that I prefer, even though, I mean, through writing and through telling stories, you can also, of course, reach another part of a reader's soul.
I'm struck by the fact that, Valeria, you didn't have to write this book. You know, you're a novelist. You didn't have to write this book, and yet you felt compelled to do so.
Yeah, there were many reasons, though. Some of them not really. They don't. I don't come across as a very nice person if I tell you, but I will tell you because I am at least an honest person. I was writing my novel before I started writing this, and I was so angry with the situation. I was going to court in that period a lot and seeing what was happening in court, and I was filled with rage and anxiety every single day, and I was pouring all of that into the novel, and the novel was becoming long Facebook posts. I don't have Facebook. So long 400 pages. So I thought, like, I'm going to kill the novel with this. That was a very important reason, and I thought, well, in order to understand what I'm seeing in court, I have to write about it. I write books in order to understand things, really. I have a series of questions and intuitions. I never have things to explain or to teach, but just a series of questions. And I did want to understand the situation. So I decided to pull all that rage out of the novel. I mean, the novel still has its doses of rage, but it's a little bit more... a little bit more self-contained, and I decided to just focus on writing this essay. I mean, it was also a lot of pressure from an editor to write this. I kept on saying no, and he kept on saying you have to. Not my editor at Coffee House, but John Freeman, a good friend of mine and my longtime editor in different projects. He kept on saying, Valeria, you have to write about what's going on in court, and I kept on saying no, I don't understand. Yet. I don't understand immigration law well. I don't have enough emotional clarity because I'm so pissed off all the time. That's what editors and good editors do. No? They get their way. eventually I said, okay, fine, I'll write this piece. Fine. Yes, fine. You're going to pay me only that? Okay, I'll write it anyway. and as I started writing it, I also lost my job in the middle. I didn't lose my job. I had to quit my job for a while because my own work permit had expired in that period, and I couldn't teach because it would have been illegal for me, and the university, that was a liability for the university. I didn't want to get in trouble either, so I had to stop teaching. And in that period, I had the time, and I had the time to study a bit and understand immigration law, read reports. And when I started writing it, I understood that, of course, that this book was the only thing I could write because I couldn't think about anything else. I couldn't dream about anything else. I couldn't talk about anything else. And I thought, if I don't write this book right now, I might as well not write anything ever.
Tan dramática.
We know a little bit.
Así somos las chilangas.
Right. Chilangas, we're very dramatic. Thank you so much for everyone who took part in this, and have a great rest of your evening. Gracias, Valeria.
Gracias a ti.
Portrait of Valeria Luiselli was produced by Maggie Freeling and Antonia Cerejido and edited by Nadia Raymond. The Latino USA team includes Marlon Bishop, Fernanda Chavarri, Andres Caballero, Janice Yamoka, Jeannie Montalvo, and Sayer Quevedo. Our intern is Reese Williams. Our engineer and music editor is Cornelius McMoyler. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Special thanks this week to Ricky Maldonado from the Poetry Project and Bernard Schwartz from the 92nd Street Y for making this live event possible. And if you like the music that you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. Our theme music was Comencemos by Zenia Rubinos. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next time. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by funds granted from the Charles H. Revson Foundation. The statements made and views expressed, however, are solely the responsibility of the author. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at www.hsfoundation.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, we go to El Rodeo, a.k.a. the rodeo.
What does she do with the lamb? She puts it on its side.
She straddles it.
She straddles it.
Straddling what? What is that, a big dog?
A goat.
I think it's maybe a lamb.
It's a goat.
That's next time on Latino USA.
Thanks for listening to Latino USA. Help us out by telling us what you like and how we could improve by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcast survey. It takes just a few minutes and you'll do all of us at Latino USA a huge favor by filling it out. That's npr.org/podcast survey. Thanks.